Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, information and an archive of past episodes. So I'm here with the one and the only Dave Martell. Most of you listening to this will be familiar with Dave. He gets around quite a bit. He's an industrious, productive guy, and he's got a lot to say on pretty much anything. And he and I have had a few conversations before, and I've always very much enjoyed them. So for those of you who don't know, Dave is the host of the YouTube channel, show The Bog, and has been for several years. He is also the host of the Culture Dads podcast, which is available through Imperium Press. And he's the editor, I believe, the founder of Bizarchives. Is that right, Dave?
Yes, sir. Editor-in-chief.
Great. Excellent. And the Bizarchives is an excellent new publication of like pulp, horror, and fantasy, which, I've been watching with eagerness. And Dave was one of the first kind of names in the heathen scene to really get behind me and the Fergan. And for that, I'm very much grateful. You know, he reached out to me when I started the Fergan channel. When I started doing videos, he left a comment of encouragement and support. And he also got me on the bog. A while back. I think it was it early last year, I think, Dave?
I believe so. It was either last year or the year before. I'm kind of starting to lose track of time with all these lockdowns.
It could well have been late 2020. He got me on there because, under my guise as a musician with Walkinsman. And it's one of the first kind of live stream interviews I did for Walkinsman, particularly associated with overtly heathen pagan channels. So that was a lot of fun, and we had a good conversation then. I've been a guest on the Culture Dads podcast as well, and we've had a couple of private chats, and Dave's a really interesting guy. And what I wanted to we've been talking about doing this podcast for a while, and the other day we had a little private chat in the Fergan Telegram chat group, and Dave brought up some really interesting topics which I wanted to discuss with him in like a one-on-one setting here. So firstly, and this is something where I'm going to hold my hands up and say that I have probably been part of propagating this misconception, which is the misconception that firstly, before we get into this, I should say, how are you doing, Dave? That's pretty rude of me not to ask how you're doing.
No, I'm doing great.
Cool. This topic in the heathen kind of movement, this general mantra that people repeat, and it's something that I've been guilty of repeating too, that we have holes in our lore and our traditions. We have gaps that not necessarily need, but could be filled by kind of outside knowledge, or could be reinforced, I think is probably a better word to use. And in a chat the other day, Dave challenged that, and I think rightfully so. So what is it you think, Dave? Why do you think people think we have these gaps in our heathen lore?
Well, firstly, I think a lot of what the heathens unfortunately learn and begin to accept as just rudimentary truths about our faith comes from academics, right? There are quite a few theories that people have like accepted as truth. Like one of them is, well, the religion is completely different from town to town, and everybody practices something completely different, and there's no coherency and there's no consistency across the board. So therefore, blah, blah, blah. And then this comes from lazy academics not wanting to put the work in and not really being smart enough to create to understand that there are fundamental beliefs and fundamental practices that are across the board of all heathenry across all of the ancient world. So they couldn't explain why these people are different than these people with these certain things. So they just said, oh, well, everybody's different. You walk, 10 miles, and then those people were doing something completely different. And they just made that up. So that became a part of an internalized heathen belief system, in at least among moderns, right? And it's something that we're trying to dispel, because the heathens did in the ancient world have consistent, coherent beliefs across the board. If they didn't, we wouldn't have the possibility of doing Indo-European comparative study, which is an immense tool. When we talk about this kind of thing, let's throw it out. A lot of times people will say, you say, well, do you believe this or do you believe that? And they'll say, no, but, everybody practiced something different back then. And that's sort of true culturally. For example, if you went to the Alps in the Bronze Age, perhaps they were bloating with wine, with grape wine. Perhaps if you go to the Teutonic lands in the Iron Age, perhaps they were bloating with beer. Perhaps they called the thunder Thunor, and perhaps you go so many miles and they call Odin Garden or whatever, right? But the basic foundational fundamental structure of the religion remained the same. Everybody understood that you go to the underworld when you die. Everybody understood that there were real deities that really existed, above us. They understood that there was a divine hierarchy. They understood reincarnation. They understood these kinds of really basic things that went into the religion. And what was different from place to place was the cultural veneer, which is certainly meaningful and certainly gives flavor and everything like that. It's not that it doesn't matter. It absolutely matters, and it's what gives localities uniqueness, and those things must be preserved and protected and regarded as sacred. But to go back into the ancient world, if you went to the ancient world and you said you told some guy in North Italy, right, when the Goths and Lombards were ruling it, and you said, hey, when I die, I'm going to go to the underworld, and they'd understand what you're talking about, and then go to Danelaw in England during that time and say, hey, guys, when I die, I'm going to go to the underworld. They're all going to understand what you're talking about. You know what I mean? Yeah. Even if they use different words or whatever, the functions and the structure of the theology and of the life and death system, all of these kind of rudimentary truths were understood across the board. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so the accusation really is that there's this kind of superficial inconsistency. And it's because of that we therefore need someone else to come in from abroad and tell us what's true, yeah, what's not true, what's bullshit and what's not bullshit. I agree, it is superficial. But when I remember years and years ago when I was first investigating paganism and trying to understand the basics of the tradition, I came across some like forums and blog articles which claimed that pagans don't believe in an afterlife. And this kind of shocked me at the time. And it was something which kind of, because I've always instinctively known that, I mean, it's just a fundamental of physics, isn't it? Energy always goes somewhere. Energy, and if, the immense kind of creative and emotional energy that makes up a man or a woman, that energy doesn't just disappear upon death. It's just, I mean, even from a scientific point of view, I think the idea of an afterlife is confirmed. So to kind of be exploring as a kind of younger man and to find these people on blogs and that saying that there is no afterlife in the pagan tradition. This isn't something that is lacking in paganism or heathenry. This is just a misunderstanding that certain people have of it. They've not delved deeply enough, because you know we can see. I think it's in Gylfaginning. There's a line in there about a man's soul does not, you know, die upon his mortal death. You know, so it, you know, you don't need to dig far to find these. You know, the aspects of our belief system presented in quite a clear manner.
Yeah, it's when it comes to, you know, afterlife, like I said, we get these kind of mantras from these academics that don't really have anything invested in this. They have no skin in the game. They don't care. They just want to get a paycheck. They work for some university and they want to create something that has this false aura of profundity to it. And what happens is, you know, heathens internalize it. And another thing that happens is we have a lot of entryists, like kind of hobbyists, that show up, and they're not really here for a faith. They're here because they have daddy issues with daddy Christianity, and they want to be reactionaries. So they LARP as this, and they kind of reject everything Christianity is. And in that, they reject fundamental things that all religions have, like after, like certain doctrines of life. You know, the Havamal is literally an entire doctrine of how to live correctly, right? That is an orthopraxis, is exactly what it is. You know, it's by divine command. It's called Words of the High One. That's Odin's words. You know what I mean? So when we get into like the fill in the gaps and the stuff from academics and stuff like that, I asked this question. I used to say this too. I was like, well, we got a lot of gaps we gotta fill, so we gotta go to these different religions and everything like that. And it really has been picked up by these like kind of new agers that, and you know, I'm not, you know, I used to say this too. So anybody that still thinks this, you know, it's nobody's fault. It's what you learn from day one. But a lot of these new agers, they don't want heathenry to be authentic. They want to do to it what they did to Celtic paganism, is they want to create this new agey kind of alternative gray space where they can go have this, liberal reinterpretation of religion with folk aesthetics to it, with a folk costume on it, but they want to continue liberals
where everything is open to interpretation. You know, they want it everything, to be this kind of they want it to be this ultra liberal thing where it is whatever you want it to be.
I see it on like Facebook groups, newcomers that will come and they're like seeking faith and seeking religion and seeking like truth, and they're seeking meaning to their existence, and they want to come home to the folk tradition. Just regular people, usually maybe not people that aren't very bright or whatever, but they're just here to learn and they want to know some things. They'll ask in these Facebook groups, where do I go when I die? That is a fundamental question that every human being ever has always asked. It is the question, right? What happens after I die? And every single time, their comment section gets swarmed with people that either tell them it nothing happens, that go back to Christianity, it's whatever you think it is, it doesn't matter, just whatever, go out into the woods and listen to the wind in the trees, and that'll tell you, and like just like this goofy stuff, and it pretty much amounts to, and it tells these poor people, we believe nothing. And there's nothing worse than telling them that. You know what I mean? Because our ancestors did have belief. They did have a sophisticated understanding of natural truths of the world. You know what I mean? So it's like it drives me crazy.
Yeah, and you brought up another really good point there, which is that so much of what we learn about paganism comes to us through academics. And those academics are invariably not pagans or heathens or even spiritual in any way. They have a completely kind of cold, empirical, detached approach to our tradition. And I've just recently got a copy of a translation of the Havamal by Cyrus Gorgani. And by the way, I highly recommend it to anyone listening, because it's a very accurate, politically neutral translation. It doesn't try and sugarcoat any of the translations. It doesn't try and hide any of the meanings or anything like that. It's a very faithful, yet, you know, still reasonably poetic translation. And in the introduction to that, and I posted about this on my Telegram channel, Cyrus points out, you know, wisely, that heathen Northern European Germanic lore is one of the only spiritual traditions in the world where almost all of the books and translations written on it are by non-practitioners. I know that there are definitely practitioners who have written books, but they tend to be the less prominent, less, you know, widely selling, widely available ones. And that's a big problem, because how can we expect an academic who doesn't have any stock in the tradition to be either honest or intellectually curious enough to philosophize about it in the way that we would? You know, why would they care if there is no explanation of the afterlife? It doesn't matter to them because it's not their religion. You know, why would they care if we are concerned about the preservation of the ethnic character of the religion? They don't care about that because it's not their, in some cases it's not even their ethnic tradition. So that's a really key point, and I'm hoping that we're going to kind of start entering an era now where more people like Cyrus Gorgani, who does have a very in-depth understanding, particularly of the runes and of texts like the Havamal, start entering the fray and producing these books. And I know that there's a channel called the Frithsted, and the guy from that channel mentioned that he has a friend who's doing a full translation, I think, of the entire Poetic Edda, and this guy is very much practicing heathen. So hopefully we're heading that way. And I know that the Norrenia Society have produced some texts, and you know, they're good people there. So yeah, I don't know if you have any comments on that yourself, Dave.
Yeah, I find it egregious that we have these people that are beholden to these either atheist or Christian or even like a lot of them are like anti-white feminists, like the worst kind of people, right? The people that we normally disregard anything that they say. But we are beholden to these people that don't even believe what we believe, don't care about what we believe, and don't care about us. They're in it for a paycheck. They're in it for notoriety among their academic community. These are the kind of people that wouldn't even talk to us if we like called them on the phone or sent them a letter or whatever. So why are we beholden to what they say? It's egregious. Think about it like this. What other religion would tolerate a system like this? Can you imagine the Hindus like listening to academics like translating the Rig Veda that are from, I don't know, China, like some Chinese atheists or some, would they tolerate American Protestants doing that for them? No. Would Catholics ever in a million years allow their scholarship going to the hands of somebody else? No. Every other serious religion on the planet, regardless if you like them or not, whether you think they're bad guys or not, every other one takes their scholarship literally or seriously, and they put it in the hands of their priests. They put it into the hands of their own scholars, their own believers. The fact that we don't have that is a huge problem.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. And you know, I've, in preparation for this discussion, I was trying to think of what holes do we actually have in our cosmogony or our wider understanding of our spiritual tradition. What holes are there? And I actually couldn't think of any. So, you know, as I said, you know, I hold my hands up and say that, you know, I may have helped to perpetuate a myth there.
You all and have, yep.
Yeah, many people have. You know, it's not just me, it's not just us, but I can't think of anything. You know, the more that time goes on, the more I learn, the more times I reread texts like the Havamal, I see that so much is contained in there that we are not left wanting for anything. You know, there's this belief among Christians, particularly, that Christianity was the origin of our Western moral system, and that before that we didn't have any morality. But I mean, one need only look at, I mean, you only need to look at the first three verses of the Havamal to see that that's complete bullshit. That you can find everything that is good about our Western moral system in the Havamal. Nothing needed to be added from elsewhere.
Yeah, exactly. I don't mean to go at the. I find that dunking on Christians at this point is like low hanging fruit. They're in such collapse and decay and their institutions are so subverted. I like almost feel bad for them. You know what I mean? So I don't really like to go out and dunk on them too much. It's just these extremely online, really spurgy, obnoxious, black-hearted, these vermin online that come and just say nasty, blasphemous stuff to us. They make it pretty easy to try to like say things. But anyway, that is mainly part of their cope. Part of their narrative is they have to believe that Christianity is the universal truth, that it is true across all of reality. And because of them, they brought enlightenment and brought Europe out of darkness, and that everything before was backwards and filthy and retarded. And that's just not true. In fact, it's kind of the opposite, right? Everybody knows, anybody that's a serious student of history knows that after the fall of Rome, the subsequent centuries were rough, right? It wasn't, until, the Renaissance, when things got less Christian, that things started getting better, right? So it's like, it's part of they must believe that everything before Christianity is, was backwards and no good. Because if they don't believe that, they're kind of, their entire religion and everything about their religion falls apart, right? So they must have this, and it behooves them to continue things like, oh, well, you guys have an incomplete tradition. You have gaps, you have this, you have that. And it's like, when it comes to heathenry, we're talking about the gaps. Like I asked, one day it just dawned on me. I was like, what gaps do we have? I was like, I read the Havamal, I read Völuspá, I read the Poetic Edda, and it answers pretty much all the questions that a religious person needs to know. Where do we come from? What are the gods? What are their names? How should we live? Where do we go when we die? Just the basic fundamental truths. And then from that, you can extrapolate and create a little bit more advanced understandings of cosmology and theology that are perfectly coherent and in line with what already exists. So it's like, what really do we need? What gaps need to be filled? We could concede that there are some aspects of like ritual itself that could probably need to be reconstructed, but we've been reconstructing it for 50 years now. There are plenty of people that know exactly how to do a ritual today. The problem that we have is it's pretty tough to, because our ancestors did these really big, ornate, beautiful rituals that went on for days and did all this kind of, and it's pretty tough to do that now when most people work 9 to 5s and only have a day off a week or something like that. So it's a little tough to recreate it 100%. But the fact of the matter is that we have a pretty darn good idea how things went. And this idea that we're here's another thing. The fact that we're called neo-pagans and we're not like anybody, like not like our ancestors. Nobody today walking around, whether we're talking Hindus or Christians or Muslims or whoever, right? Any religious person, Buddhist, walking around today does not practice the way their ancestors did thousands of years ago. So if we're neo-pagans, they're neo-Christians, they're neo-Buddhists, they're neo-Hindus. That's just the fact of the matter.
Yeah, I've always hated, I've actually just always hated the prefix neo, because it suggests that it's something entirely different from what it was before. And in most cases, it's not. It's just I think that's like kind of like a hangover from this idea that it's not a living tradition. This is another problem that I have with certain kind of people who, they are genuine heathens in our circles, but they're quite academic, and you will actually catch them referring to things in the past. They will say things like Woden was this, or Yngvi Frey was this. And I'm kind of thinking, do you not think that those deities are, as in the present tense, and I think this is kind of like a sort of hangover from that. You're right. I think a lot of you're right. It does behoove Christians to try and claim that we don't have a complete tradition. And although they, as you pointed out, they might be right in terms of the finer details of the ritual. But then again, I mean, what is a Christian ritual these days? It's a very simple, very kind of regimented affair with absolutely no soul to it whatsoever. Yeah. People turn
especially
up
among the Protestants.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, yeah, you're right there. I mean, it is more, it has a greater richness to it in the Catholic and the Orthodox traditions. And you're right there. But yeah, people turn up at a specific time on a specific day. They stand there like an audience, you know, not really participating, maybe singing a few songs that they've sung before. Do they really feel the words that they're singing? Do they even think about them while they're singing them? Or are they just going through the motions? Yeah. Whereas, you know, I think it's disingenuous of most Christians, I would say, to try and claim that they have a more comprehensive understanding of their tradition than we have of ours. We do have work to do, particularly on the ritual side of things, but I mean, that's kind of, we'll get there really soon with that. We'll get there really soon. And it's, you know, I don't think that detracts from the kind of wealth of understanding or what we get from it. That doesn't detract from any of that. You know, we're just, because a lot of the time what we're doing in ritual is quite instinctive. And I personally have always felt that that shows more sincerity than reading from, you know, like a sheet and then singing certain words from a hymn book and then standing and listening to the vicar or the priest at the front of the hall. And, you know, that's all there is to it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of this, like we're talking about, a lot of these mantras that people have internalized, unfortunately poisons what could be, you know, what needs to be our strengths. You know, a lot of people, you'll hear this, and that you mentioned about how people that are academically will say were about the gods and stuff like that. Another thing that I've noticed that we need to just strike from our vocabulary is this, well, I believe, or I think, or that, instead of this is, or that is, because we are kind of sheepish about being definite about what we believe. You know, I know that the gods are true, and I know that the gods are real. I've experienced them. You know what I mean? I do my best, at least, to live in accordance with, I literally believe when I read the Havamal that these are Odin's words, right? I literally believe that. So it's like, why am I beating around the bush and tiptoeing and walking on eggshells when I say that these words are the words of the gods? Why can't I say that? And we've had this kind of sheepishness of say, because it's this inborn Christian reactionism, it's this inborn liberalism, this internalized liberalism, this internalized reactionism, not just to Christianity, but to authority. And that just needs to die, because our ancestors believed very, very deeply in hierarchy. They had a caste system. You know what I mean? And if you bring that up to New Agers, oh, it's a big, you know, hoopla. You can't bring up that there's a caste system, because they are inherently liberal. And here's the thing is that, and then there's more mantras like every man is his own priest. That's just not true. You know what I mean? Every man of the house, the paterfamilias, as the Romans called him, the house father, the husvater, as we call it, is in charge of doing the family's rituals, right? He's in charge of doing the ancestor worship, king worship. He's in charge of leading the family in ritual with that. But he is not like a high gothi or something like that. You know what I mean? There needs to be a higher hierarchy of priesthood that is in charge of the grand bloats and grand rituals and stuff like this. We had this, right? So it's like this idea that there is no hierarchy, there is no authority. Every man is his own priest, and every man is equal. It's just not the case. And we need to get away from that. We need to strike these kinds of this wishy-washy, spineless jellyfish language from our vernacular, because it hurts us. One thing we need to do, because this really hurts. What I've noticed is that when you start to strike this away and you start to say, guys, this is true. The gods are. This is. And not I think or I believe or this is my gnosis or whatever. This is and yeah, there's room for people to have gnosis, absolutely. And when you do propose your gnosis, you should say that, right? Well, this is how I understand it, or this is what. And there's absolutely room for that with everything, right? But yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna say just quickly, but when that gnosis conflicts with what we know from the law, from the original sources, then it should be put under question. You know, like exactly. You can't have gnosis about something which fundamentally conflicts with something in the Poetic Edda.
Exactly. If it's the hierarchy of sources, if it does not have what's called an epistemological warrant, then it cannot be, and it must be scrutinized, right? It's like, and this has just gone on for too long that people are just allowed to say whatever they want, even if it is just completely, utterly ridiculous and incoherent with what we know to be true, right? So when we kind of get rid of these things, and I've noticed among my own kin, when we start being more like intolerant to stuff that is incoherent, and we begin to like really, really accept the fundamental truths, the foundational truths of our faith, people take the ritual much more seriously. And when you go into ritual, we do things like we do like the cleansing, and this is something that's in the sources. We wash our mouths out, we wash our hands, right? We wipe our faces down with the water before we enter the sacred space. And when you do these kinds of things, like you're like, I have to wash my mouth out before I speak to the gods. That's something our ancestors did. And when you do stuff like that, it makes the ritual so much more serious, so much more pious, and it so much more meaningful and special. It's a much more spiritual experience than just like a bunch of Joes showing up in like t-shirts and jeans and like just like standing around a fire and drinking from a horn, which is fine. You know what I mean? But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're right there. And this is something I've mentioned recently that I need to work on, because I've not, my kind of mentors in, you know, communal heathen practice have not generally held to this idea of, you know, ablution and cleanliness before the rite. But the more I think about it, the more sense it makes, particularly in light of some of the comments that were made recently and how fragrances, you know, your mind has this particularly strong, makes a particularly strong connection between fragrance and memory. So by putting a certain fragrance in front of someone, you can instantly transport their mind and their emotional being back to a particular, event in the past. And that's how we can, that's how we can recreate that, the same feeling through each of our rituals. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, there I go saying it, but a lot of people believe, and I would say that this is undoubtedly true, is that the idea of ritual is to maintain that connection back to the beginning, back to the origin.
Yeah.
And this is one way of doing it. And yeah, I mean, you know, when I think to, you know, when I was younger and, you know, Sunday dinner with my, say, with my grandparents consisted of, you know, looking good and, you know, making sure you were clean. If you'd been out playing outside with your brothers or whatever, and you were filthy, you had to clean before you came in. And washing hands isn't just like a thing to combat like bacteria or anything. It's there's more of a kind of symbolic aspect to that. You're making yourself clean before a formal event, and because of that, that event takes on a greater kind of importance subconsciously. You know, when you sat down to eat after washing and, you know, putting on a shirt and stuff like that, you know, in that more formal setting, that you are experiencing something slightly out of step with your normal routine, something or, you know, it could be part of a routine, but what I mean is it's not a daily occurrence, it's not a regular thing. This is something that you are doing especially for this week, this day of the week, you're doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. When you are performing ritual, you're entering the sacred space that transcends time and place, right? Yeah. So you're going into the hall of the gods. You're going to speak with the gods. You're going to speak with your ancestors. You know, why wouldn't you want to be clean? Why wouldn't you want to be your best? You know, why wouldn't you want to leave behind the miasma of the mundane modern world and go, you know, when you commune with them, make it be special, make it be something different. You know, my kindred, when we do our ritual, we wear what we call bloat kalavi, which is something that's attested in the sources. We wear white. And we've been, you know, there's been times that people from outside are like, oh, you guys look like a cult or something like that, because they're, you know, they're clinging on to this new age stuff. Go to any ritual anywhere in the world. Go to where the Hindus all get together and they say, and it's a beautiful thing when the Hindus get together, they sing their mantras together and they're all wearing white, right? The priests, the yogis or whatever, the guys that are all wearing white, because white is a color of purity. We know that our ancestors wore white. They wore white linen specifically. So these kinds of things. And let me tell you guys that maybe haven't practiced like this. When you put on your bloat clothy, now it's like, I don't put my bloat clothy on for any other time. When I put my bloat clothy on, and you mentioned fragrance, I actually, I make cinnamon incense. And that's what I have burned at bloat, burned at ritual every single time for the last like 12 years. So anytime when people smell that cinnamon, when I smell that cinnamon, I put on my bloat clothy, I wash myself down, I go, that puts me in ritual mode. I'm a different person. The parts of Dave that belong to the mundane modern world are gone. I take those off and I go before the gods and I go before my ancestors, pure as I can be, right? And this is, it's just a wonderful experience. It's a special experience. And it's something that I think that heathens need to really start taking serious in order to take it to the next level. This kind of wishy-washy pseudo-libertarian approach to religion is just, it's not historically accurate. And two, it's not functionally effective. There's a reason that we haven't really gone anywhere, because we have this kind of like this new agey kind of theme of individualism that goes through. Individualism and libertarianism does not work in politics. It will never work in religion. So the only way that people move forward is if they work together, they're cooperative. Our ancestors were, individualism would have sounded completely alien to them. So this idea of in-group, this idea of cooperation, of collectivism, this idea of collective identity, these ideas that our ancestors were, it was just natural to them. We need to readopt them if we want to succeed. And I really, I think that we can and we will succeed as long as we shed some of those like really destructive, self-serving, practically subversive ideas, right?
Yeah, and I think that there's also this another obstacle that we have to the kind of reemergence of widespread pagan practice is that we're so cynical in our modern age. You know, the idea of you know, commanding your entire family to go get a bath or a shower, put on certain sets of clothes, to go out and stand perhaps even just in your backyard, just with your members of your family, if you just have a small family kindred for that particular, you know, high holy day. A lot of in our kind of modern minds, this idea, you know, we're so cynical of stuff like that. You know, we think, I sometimes notice that even people who do go through with that ritual, they can't help but make jokes along the way, because it's almost a little bit uncomfortable to them. The idea that they're doing this very kind of serious formal procedure merely to go and talk to thin air, you know, and I'm not saying that they don't believe in the gods and ancestors, they do, but it's very difficult having grown up in our Western world, which is very materialist. And, you know, even the Christians who go to church every Sunday, most of them don't really believe. They don't really believe. They're cultural Christians for the most part. And it's easy to be part of that, that routine, that kind of tradition of going to church on a Sunday when it's a community thing, when you can kind of explain it away that way. You know, you can say to yourself, I'm getting washed and clean to go and, you know, hang out with my community and sing some songs, you know, rather than saying I'm getting washed and clean to go and speak to my gods and ancestors. There's this, you know, do you get what I mean when I say that? This kind of cynical aspect of the modern Western mind.
Yeah, it's and it has really been amplified with postmodernity. We have this kind of instinct to deconstruct and to make jokes of and to mock and to be ironic and be sarcastic about everything, right? Anything serious, we have this instinct to break it down, and it's frankly there's nothing good about it. There's nothing good that can come from it. It doesn't have the generative energy that we need to move forward. This whole idea that everything can just be a meme, everything can just be a joke, everything is blah blah blah, you know, everything we can make. No, I don't think that there are things that there must be things that are sacred that you can't joke about. There are things that are sacred that you can't make fun of. There are things that are sacred that should not be deconstructed. I don't like if somebody sends me like a silly meme that has like about the gods or whatever. I scold them. I say, don't send me this shit ever again. I don't want to see that. You're right. Because to me, that's like I'm somebody that you could say that I'm superstitious or whatever. But when I see blasphemous stuff, it upsets me because I really fear punishment. I fear punishment. I fear just insulting them. I don't even want to insult them because I really do view them as my ruler, as our kings and our queens, right? These are the most powerful beings in the universe. Why would we want to clown on them and make fun of them when especially now when we have an insurmountable foe coming to crush us? We need their love and we need their support more than ever. And to like mock them and make fun of them just makes my stomach churn.
Yeah. And this is, I think this is one of the reasons that joining together with like a larger heathen group, even if it means having to travel 2-3 hours, you know, maybe even more in some cases. I mean, I've driven many, many times over the last 10, 15 years, I've driven 4 hours to go blot with a group. But it's important to do that because there is something, particularly when you're newer to it and you do feel that kind of slight awkwardness of performing a ritual with either just your family or your partner or a very small local group. That awkwardness is overcome when you're with 20 other people, all of whom are there. They've traveled for that specific reason to honor the gods and ancestors. The awkwardness, you know, kind of simultaneously floats away from everyone when you're in that setting. And once you've done that a few times, you can take that same mentality to your smaller local, even home blots. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, another thing that I think for me, an intrinsic part of the pagan mindset is the idea, or, you know, perhaps I should be fair and say the spiritual mindset is the idea that you are being watched at all times, and particularly in the pagan tradition, by your ancestors. So, you know, once I started to think that way, and I think I kind of always instinctively did feel that way, but once I started to think, you know, my English grandfather, who I look up to immensely, you know, I've got two English grandparents and two Dutch grandparents. My Dutch grandparents are still alive. Both of my English grandparents passed away a long time ago. And even though my grandfather was kind of a flawed man, you know, he had his faults and he made a few mistakes, but overall he was a really good example, a really honorable man. He was an artistic man. He achieved a lot in his lifetime. He went to war at the age of 15. You know, he was a good, upstanding Englishman, you know, a real kind of, you know, an example of the best of the English folk. I think about him whenever I do something which I know is even slightly degenerate. You know, like the idea now of masturbating is abhorrent to me because I can just, all I can think about is being, you know, and, you know, there'll be people who kind of put like a filthy spin on this, but being watched doing such depraved acts by your ancestors rather than putting that time and energy to good use. It's just dishonorable. And I think this, you know, for anyone out there who, you know, perhaps still hasn't kicked that habit, think of it that way. Think about if, you know, if you pass on from this realm and then you, from however it happens, you look down upon your descendants and all you see is them growing fat, masturbating every other day, you know, watching pornography, watching shit, you know, television programs, whatever, not applying themselves in any way to their life, not taking care of the body that you have gifted to them. You know, that is shameful. And imagine watching your descendants do that. Now put yourself back in your shoes as the descendant of ancestors who are deceased now, and imagine them having to watch you do all this shit to yourself. So, you know, when I, for example, I work out regularly and I don't think I've missed a week of working out other than when I've been on tour or something for nearly 20 years, I would say now. And part of the reason for that is, again, it's this idea that I want to make my ancestors and gods proud. I want to make the most of this physical form that was given to me by them. So, you know, why am I not applying that same mentality when it comes to ablution and being clean before a rite? You know, I mean, this is a bit of a revelation for me recently. It's not something, as I say, that I've paid enough attention to, but it makes perfect sense in the context of wanting to present the best version of yourself to your gods.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, cool. Well, you mentioned just a little while ago, you mentioned the word kindred. And I think that's a good segue into the other thing that I wanted to discuss with you. You mentioned in a private chat, you mentioned quite strongly your view on the idea of kindreds versus clans and this idea of orthodoxy. And we have touched upon that a little bit already, but specifically, what is, you know, because I've not heard anyone else speak so kind of passionately about this as you, firstly, if you could kind of introduce this idea of what a clan is, what a kindred is, and why you are so much more in favor of the former.
So a clan is the traditional familial structure for pretty much all of human history. A clan is a collection of families that are bonded by blood and marriage, and they exist in a collective. Generally, in the ancient times, they lived on family estates. And this was actually a practice up until sort of recently. Our great-grandparents in certain places in more rural areas still lived in this kind of structure. It wasn't until the advent of global industry and capitalism and, well, more specifically, industrialism, when we started having factories and more urban lifestyle, was the family unit reduced to what we now call the nuclear family. It's called the nuclear family just because it's the nucleus of the family. Modernity reduced it down to a smaller form of its nucleus and got rid of all of its exterior. So a lot of people that clutch pearls, they self proclaimed conservatives that want to conserve the nuclear family, are trying to conserve something that has already been deconstructed by modernity. The clan structure is the proper traditional family unit, and this is a familial structure of multiple families tied by blood and marriage, led by a house father. So this is the traditional way of doing it, and this is a type of organization that we need to work back into. The problem is that we don't have that anymore. For three generations, four generations, we have had the nuclear family. So going back into this, a lot of our heathens will organize in what are called kindreds. And kindred is a term that was actually coined by Mr. McNallan, the great Mr. Stephen McNallan, who I've had the pleasure to work with a little bit, and a guy that I really like. And this was kind of his proposal of how to organize. The thing is that the kindred, it's what we have right now, but it is a secular simulation of the clan. We bring people together and we try to swear oaths in order to get people to stay together. And we pretty much, it is a modern simulation of the clan. It's not a true clan, which is, you know, I mean, it's what we got to work with right now.
Sorry, go on.
No, but due to modernity, it's not really as effective as we would like it to be. Anybody here that has been a part of a kindred or led a kindred knows that people will just walk away. People will just change their minds. People will get into arguments and storm off and not come back. People will. It's just until there is blood and marriage, real, real ties that bind people, your kindred will forever be a secular organization based on ideas instead of bonded by blood. Like I said, that's what we have to work with. It's what we got, but we need to work into a clan. And the only way we can get into a clan structure is if we begin to become intolerant, right? Every successful in-group, whether it's a religious thing, a political thing, an ethnic thing, has had unwavering in-group preference. We need to adopt intolerance. Things like, we don't recognize marriages as legitimate unless they're heathen marriages. you must marry a heathen. And if you marry somebody that is not a heathen, they must convert. We don't tolerate other, we just have to become intolerant to these things and demand that everybody participates, adheres to the tradition, right? If the tradition does not have authority, then it is not a tradition. We need it to be a tradition.
Yeah, that's profound, Dave. That actually answers some questions I've had over the last few years about how we get out of this mess that we're in, kind of socio-politically. Because, you know, I've been like yourself, I've been part of Kindreds, and you know, you can perform like an oathing rite, which at the time feels so genuine, and you feel like this guy is your brother. And then only for, you know, a couple of years later, he'll literally go AWOL. You won't hear from him again. He won't turn up to any moots anymore. He won't respond to your emails, nothing. Unfortunately, I had this experience with a guy who essentially at the outbreak of, you know, so-called COVID, he cut ties with everyone. And I think it's because he did and still does hold a very different view of what the whole COVID thing is about to the rest of us, which is unfortunate. But the point is, you know, this guy was not just the guy who was oathed to me and myself to him, but he was a guy who had produced some really great, books. He'd written books for the heathen movement. He'd written blogs. You know, I'm not going to name who he is, but he was an important guy in the scene. But one day he just disappeared, and he won't reply to anyone's messages, no one's emails. I mean, to be fair, we don't know for sure that he hasn't passed away, but I don't think that that's the case, but I'm not entirely sure. But there are examples like that. And you're right, you can't walk away from family ties anywhere near as easily as you can walk away from these kind of, you know, superficial kindred ties, even though, you know, we're forced to do this because of the world we live in. You know, in Britain, a previous prime minister of ours, Margaret Thatcher, she said, get on your bikes. And what she was referring to then is, if you can't find work where you and your family grew up, you're just going to have to move somewhere where there is work. And that kind of set the tone for the whole, you know, British society we have now, where for the last kind of two or three generations, it's been very common for children to grow up and then move to a city the other end of the country. And then, one, you know, they'll go to university there, they'll settle there, they'll meet someone there, then they'll buy a house there. And then all of a sudden you've got siblings who are spread around the country, all having families, different places around the country. And the whole kind of opportunity for a clan system has been destroyed. That and the fact that we're not raised as heathens anymore, so we don't see the importance of the clan structure. So I think, do you think that one of the ways that we're going to get back to this is because we're now at a stage where we've got like a generation of parental heathens, you know, people like you, yourself and I, you've got children, I've got children. Presumably you're raising your children heathen as I am as well. You know, my children have even got names, which two of them have got names which are directly linked to two of our gods. So, you know, that they kind of, that I've set the tone for them to grow up, hopefully, potentially in a clan system. I don't know how that's going to work out. What with moving to Wales, you know, which, you know, isn't traditionally part of the, you know, Germanic pagan society. But then again, there are a lot of English people there, so we'll see how that goes. But do you think that we're going to start entering an era now where, because there are more parents, more elderly people like the great Mr. McNallan, who you mentioned, that there are now children who are growing up being raised heathen more so than ever, I would say. Is that going to be what brings us back to this clan system?
Yeah. Well, there's going to be two pressures, I believe. As you know about the economic situation that we're heading towards, we're not going to have the luxury of previous decades and eras where children could just get up and move and go wherever they want and explore and do all this kind of stuff. People are going to have to work together very, very soon. And this is going to be an environmental pressure that forces people together. Another thing is, yes, not only do we have second generation heathens walking around, we have parental heathens, as you said, we have second and third generation. I went to the Folkish Summer Hollowing last year, and I met two people who had children whose parents were there. So there are third generation heathens walking around. People, yeah. You know, I met one couple, the young lady, her father was the first heathen in the family. All of his kids were heathens. They all got married to heathens, and they're all having and raising heathen children. This is what we need to do. The path to victory is through having children, through marriage, through blood ties. This is the path to victory, the path to growth, and this an intolerance to traditions that are not our own. This is the way forward, and it's going to be tough because, as you mentioned, all of society encourages children to leave, which is just grotesque, right? This is a monstrous practice. I went so every year I go, me and my family, we go back to this kind of neighborhood that's close to where I grew up to go trick or treating. And you guys that aren't familiar with trick or treating that are in other countries, you go around, knock on doors and get candy Halloween, right? I'm sure people have heard of it, but we go around, knock on doors, get candy or whatever. And I remember being a kid going through these neighborhoods, and there was just like crowds of kids everywhere. The place was just packed. You know what I mean? Kids running everywhere in their costumes, getting candy, big bags of candy. You go there now, it is nothing but old people. We might have seen maybe 8 or 9 families with kids walking around in this neighborhood that has thousands of people, right? So these people are conservative people. You go through, you see Trump signs in their yards. These aren't like inner city urbanite libtards, right? These are supposed conservative people. Every single one of them, you talk to them, they say, oh man, I miss when all the kids were here. My kids moved to Colorado, or my kids moved to Texas, or my kids moved to blah, 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 and they're not here anymore. They all sent their kids away, and now the place is barren and childless. And this is a problem across the entirety of the West. The capitalism, industrialism has broken us from our just very basic family traditions and obligations to our parents and our families, and sent them off and to float in the sea like these are selective insects, right? We just spit them out into the sea to go find their own way, where most of them find a pretty meager existence, a very less than meaningful existence, and have less children because they don't have the familial infrastructure to help raise more than 2-3 kids. I'm telling you, my mom is around, but we don't really have this big familial structure, and we have 3 kids, and it is hard. It is not easy to be outnumbered by your own kids, right?
Yeah, well, tell me about that. I mean, my wife and I, we moved from one end of England to the other, and we were kind of forced to because we couldn't afford to buy a house in the southeast of England because it's simply too expensive. So, you know, we're raising 3 children now, the oldest of whom is 9. And we've pretty much during the entirety of those 9 years, at least 7 or 8 of them, we've not had any nearby babysitters. You know, it's been really tough raising those, you know, obviously rewarding and enjoyable, but it's been tough without having any family infrastructure. So I know how that is. And it's entirely by design, you know, and I mentioned briefly that we're moving house, which is hopefully actually happening next week. And what we're doing, we're actually buying a large property with my mother and one of my brothers. And it's precisely with this idea in mind of kind of reinstating a larger family infrastructure. And we're going to be encouraging our children to stay for as long as they want. You know, there should be room for them to stay, you know, not mega spacious, but there'll be room for them to stay indefinitely as long as they want to. And it's all with this idea in mind of creating this support structure where everyone has a home that they can always return to, where they have family around. And, you know, I just wanted to like kind of move over because we've talked about the impact of this kind of atomization and this like kind of separation of the wider family and the impact that has on heathenry as a traditional movement. But also, you know, I made a post on my Telegram recently, and I think you'll agree with this, Dave, that the one unstoppable force which can probably, restore dignity to our folk in this world would be the reemergence of bands of men, of brothers who trust each other implicitly and to the fullest extent and know that they can rely on the others at all times. That is the kind of thing which will pose a serious threat to our enemies who have this stranglehold over us. So again, that's where the importance of the clan system comes in. Yeah, do you have any thoughts on that, like the more masculine kind of aspect of the clan system, the need for that like band of brothers?
Yeah, I do. But before we get into the Manor Bun discussion, I wanted to mention about your previous comments. In order for these kinds of things to work, in order for our kids to stay, in order for our kids to, we must return power to the father. We must encourage, upholding traditional obligations. We must be willing to say that I don't approve of you moving, son. I don't approve of this woman you're courting. I don't approve of this, or I do approve of this, and becoming intolerant to behaviors that are not good for the family. Your son moving across the country is terrible for the family. And to remind him, no, you are needed here. You are needed. You have obligations to your family. This idea of free-floating personal autonomy is a completely liberal invention. Your family is under your command until you pass and it goes to your son. And then your family is under his command. And that must be reinstated. And unfortunately, it's hard because now the state is the daddy and the state has removed the power of the father. But the power of the father, we must reduce the autonomy of people. We must reduce the autonomy of our family. We must work to enforce these kinds of obligations to our family and our traditions. If we don't, people are just going to go do whatever they want and nothing that we want to happen will happen. And this also plays into the Manor Bund thing. When you have a collection of powerful men, this is an institution in of itself, right? A collective of house fathers, a collective of men that get together, that coach and teach younger men and help them come up, give them rites of passage. This is an institution that every powerful, every healthy, every good society, every great society that we view throughout history had this, right? It started at the bottom with the Manor Buns. It started at the bottom with collectives of house fathers that ran the communities. This is what makes healthy, high trust communities, and this builds up into a healthy nation. Without this, you have no nation, and that is why today we have no nation. The Manor Bund must come back. The power of the father must come back. You know,
I think it's essential. I think it's essential. It's not just preferable. It is actually essential. I don't think we're going to achieve anything without restoring that.
Exactly. Exactly. And there are some groups that try to do this, right? Young men get together, they start little clubs. Like we mentioned with Kindreds, they say oaths to one another, which is good, right? Saying oaths is an important part, but we have no means in modernity to enforce them, right? Mm. So we really need to think about enforcing them. We need to not be scared to deal out consequences to people that break their oaths, right? We all talk about how lowly and shitty the oath breaker is, but nobody is willing to come out and say, this guy is an oath breaker. He has brought shame to us and for everybody to be in lockstep and be like, no, dude, we don't talk to you anymore. You know, the Amish are very, very effective with this. If you don't come back after your Rumspringa, you are shunned. You lose everything. You are gone. They don't talk to you anymore. You're not allowed back. That's it. It doesn't matter if they loved you and you were their child. If you break your obligation to the family, to the tradition, you are not allowed back. And we need to start enforcing this. If there is no fear of repercussion, there is no power of consequence, pretty much what we say, our oaths, our traditions mean nothing. Right.
Yeah.
And this goes to the Manor Buns as well, where these crazy turnover rates. They have more turnover rates than like McDonald's does.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking while you were saying all of that, you know, the example of having a son who perhaps decides that he wants to, you know, move to the other end of the country or maybe even move abroad or something like that. And, you know, you're there as the father and you're saying, no, you know, you're needed here. You have an obligation here. You're not doing that. In our modern age, I can just, we can all imagine the son just saying, well, screw you, dad. You know, I'm off. I'm going. You know, what of it? I'll see you at Christmas, you know, or as we'd call it, Yule, you know. But, you know, if there is this like band of men, if you are the father of a household and you have, you know, two brothers who are the heads of households as well, and together with them and their sons and perhaps even, you know, other extended men of the area, you have this clan together that are tied by blood, through intermarriage and things, then your son saying, no, I'm going to go and move to the other end of the country, they then forfeit all of the benefits that come with being part of that clan, all of the protection that comes with that. That's what we need to bring back is this idea that, you know, and we see this, you know, I think you're alluding to groups like Operation Werewolf, you know, and I think, you know, what they're doing is great. I don't know the ins and outs of exactly the Wolves of Vinland, you know, as I know as the group, and Operation Werewolf is like the kind of philosophy behind it, but I don't know the ins and outs of it, but that is a great thing. And, you know, people want to be part of that. I mean, I've known many people over the last like 5-10 years who've desperately wanted to be part of this kind of emerging, you know, online brotherhood, you know, and, you know, yes, it's kind of partially online. You're learning about it by the internet and you're trying to form your own little band of men, but people want to be part of this bigger thing. And I think you can imagine our male ancestors having the exact same mindset. They wanted to be part of something strong. So in the context of that, in the context of a healthy clan, your son doesn't want to forfeit being part of that clan to go and move somewhere else. So it's not even a question, right?
Yeah, exactly. You nailed it right on the head. That's you need the entire infrastructure of the Mannerbund, of the clan, and not just the clan, the clans, if somebody inherently just knows that if they leave, they leave everything behind. Everybody that they love, everybody they care about, they leave behind, not just all of their family structure and all of the benefits that come with that. They also lose the economic benefits that come with that. And that is going to be my next point. We do need a focus on economics, right? We need a focus on becoming prosperous. There's this kind of cultural Protestantism that goes in with heathenry, where it's like there's this kind of like being against being rich, this I don't need this, that I'm against materialism and I'm against this and that, and the people are like, oh, I'm a minimalist, I'm this and that. That's not how our ancestors viewed things. Our ancestors weren't like that. Our ancestors believed that wealth was a gift from the gods. Our ancestors were trying to get rich, right? They were monopolizing trade routes. They were businessmen. They were rocking the fanciest, nicest clothes of the time that were colored with the most expensive dyes. They painted their house in the most expensive dyes. These were colorful, vibrant. Our ancestors had more in common with like Tony Soprano than they did with the History Channel Ragnar, right? They were like this.
Yeah.
They wore gold and silver. They had slaves that they would just walk around with them just to flex, right? They would just like walk around, look how fucking rich I am, because that was a gift from the gods. And they worked very tirelessly to achieve this level of wealth. With wealth comes power, and with power comes freedom. And until we wield actual wealth, we will not wield power and we will not have freedom. We as a folk must come together. And I love the little, because it is so beautiful that we have so many like little craftsmen and artists. We are one of the most creative demographics on the planet. You go to any heathen gathering, people make little knickknacks. Everybody you meet either is a musician or a craftsman or an artist or a writer or a poet. Everybody does something, makes candles, something or other. And it's very, because industriousness is part of our faith, right? So we see that. However, I do think that it is time to professionalize and get into things that bring real, real money. Because the problem with this is that with these kinds of very like heathen cultural crafts and art and stuff like that, we only really gain interest from an insular economy. This economy that exists with one another, and our money kind of just keeps going in a cycle among ourselves. What we need to really do is start taking money from the Volha, taking money from the Utengard, from the outsiders. We need to start taking their money, whether it's something like creating server farms, creating like a concrete manufacturing thing, maybe like a franchise of construction work, this kind of stuff. Really, really big things in order to flow big money into our faith. Because let's think about it like this: heathenry, and this is at least in America, the heathen revival started around in the 60s, right? That's where it really kicked up. This happened around the same time Hare Krishna came to America. Hare Krishna has temples everywhere. They have millions and millions of dollars to work with. They have lobbyists in the government. They wield wealth and power. We, on the other hand, have maybe a dozen or so temples across all organizations across the entire country. That is not even nearly enough. You know, no. There's also a few other things that we need to go into, but economy is something that we really need to focus on. Without wealth, we do nothing. And our ancestors believe very deeply that wealth was a gift from the gods. This kind of anti-material, minimalist cultural Protestantism is not authentically heathen. This was brought in by modernity.
Yeah, I'll just interject there by saying that, you know, this might kind of on the surface of it sound a bit kind of wishy-washy and new agey to some of the listeners there, but there is a reason that the word current and currency are so similar, because currency is in, you know, money. All it is a representation of your sweat labor, of your abilities, of your creativity, of your energy. So to say that, you know, money is evil, the pursuit of it in certain moral ways can be, but money is not evil, because all it is a representation of your will to power, essentially. So, you know, I made a post on the Telegram channel recently where I quoted a verse from Havamal saying that it's better to have, you know, a small hall with just twigs for a roof and a she-goat, but to be the lord of that rather than, you know, it's better to have that than nothing at all. That shouldn't be taken as a, promotion of this kind of anti-materialist, you know, it's good to be poor Protestant mindset. It's just to say, that is better than illusory wealth, but genuine wealth is better than that, undoubtedly. And I fully agree with you when you say we need to draw that currency, that current, from outside of our circles. We need to bring it into our world, and that through doing that, we will become more influential, more powerful. And I fully agree with you there, Dave.
Yeah, there was one thing that I noticed growing up. My mom's family are Italian Catholics. My dad's family are Pennsylvania Dutch, Pennsylvania German Protestants. One thing I noticed about my mom's family, and my wife is half Italian as well, Italian Catholic. The Italian Catholics always seem to be able to pay for everything. They always seem to have wealth. They always seem to be able to pull things off, right? Mm. If you look at how their culture works, their culture is very much about exchange of wealth. It is. If you go to an Italian wedding, guys show up with envelopes of stacks of cash, big gifts, all of this kind of stuff. This is something that our ancestors had, our Germanic ancestors had, that we need to bring back. You know, this idea that giving a big gift is something that is, a sign of status, is something to be proud of. Oh, yeah, well, my boy just got married. I dropped 2 G's on him. You know what I mean? You show up like the man, and you pull this big fat envelope out, and you hand it to the wife at the wedding. That's a big deal. We need to start having these big weddings where we just exchange wealth, exchange gifts, and not just like, you know, little knickknacks and exchanging the books and exchanging stuff that we like is beautiful too. We have a wonderful culture of gift giving, but we need to modernize a little bit. And I know I just hate saying that, but it's true. in order for us to be successful, we have to do this. We have to create this culture of wealth and success. Because you better believe if we teleported our ancestors to today, they'd be like, okay, let's get to work and let's get money, right? That's exactly what they would have been doing. Everything that they did was about trying to achieve power, to give their family, their kindred, their kinsmen freedom in that world by making sure they had something to eat, to making sure they had plenty, you know, all of their needs are met, plus, right, to defend against other invading groups or whatever. So yeah, no, it's just we've got a lot to work on, and I think that there's a few cultural currents in our faith that need to be brought up a level, and some of it needs to go, right? Yeah. But no, that thing that you just go ahead.
That exchange of gifts, as you said, like at a wedding or something like that. I mean, that also reinforces the clan mindset, because you know people can try and deny it, but when someone gives you a big gift, you do feel a certain sense of obligation to them. It's just human nature.
Yes. Yep. Big time. If you're sitting there newly married, your beautiful bride, and your uncle or your cousin or even just a fellow heathen rolls up and gives you a couple $1,000, just that's it. Here you go. You know, congratulations, blessings to you. You now are like, okay, well, when this guy's son gets married, wait till you see with the gift that I give him, right? So it becomes this exchange of wealth that grows over time, and everybody gets to, it's not like you go out there and you start with nothing and you have to scrape and claw and get your, and then build up to mediocrity. The support of the clan structure of the community starts you out with a head start. That's our whole job, is to do that. And then the more people that start with head starts, the more wealth that they gather. You know, in America, Indians do this. They exchange wealth. They give big gifts to each other. They give each other jobs.
Yeah.
And because of that, they are the second richest per capita, per household ethnic group in America. You know what I mean?
Over here, they don't, you know, when a young Indian family wants to buy a house, and this also goes for the Muslims here as well, when they want to buy a new house, they don't take out a mortgage. They don't borrow the money from the bank. They borrow that money from their wider network, their clan, essentially. They borrow that money from them. They're probably gifted some of it. Some of it they probably borrow at zero interest because, you know, they have this prohibition of usury and things like that as well. They essentially, you know, the immigrants in our lands who have these tight-knit communities, they live more in a clan-style system than we do in our own countries.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, that we've discussed everything. I'm really pleased with how this discussion has gone, and we've touched on everything I wanted to, and I think it's been a great talk. So, I mean, rather than kind of, you know, talking for another hour, which I'm sure we could do, I'd like to, you know, get you on another time, Dave, like maybe in another like 5-10 episodes or something pretty soon. And I'm sure we can have another great conversation on something else as well. But is there anything you wanted to add to, you know, any kind of thoughts that have been left unspoken that you'd like to just drop in at the end here? And then, you know, please feel free to shill in your wonderful style, all of the stuff that you're involved with as well, and let people know what you do.
Yeah, well, Mr. Dan, thank you so much for coming on. I always love getting on talking with you. Yeah, you're one of my favorite people in the whole thing, and I love your music. I love all your work. So it's just a pleasure to get on and talk to you. The only thing I would say is we need to stop being allergic to ideas of hierarchy. To stop being allergic to ideas of authority, words like orthodoxy, words like doctrine, words like dogma. Our ancestors had these things, right? Our ancestors believed these things. These aren't just Christian things. These are things orthodox. The word it comes from the word orthodoxos, which was a Greek word that meant the correct way to believe or the correct way to think, right? Things like orthopraxy. The correct way to practice, the correct way to worship. You know, nobody would argue that there is, nobody would say that all ways of worship are completely true, right? If you go to like a universalist, gathering, some of the stuff that they do is absolutely abhorrent. And even the most reactionary of folkish heathens would look at what they do. They put dildos on their altars. They do like really bizarre things would be.
Are you kidding?
No, they put dildos, like rainbow dildos. They make like monkey statues that are supposed. They do really bizarre shit because they do not believe in orthodoxy. They think that everything is valid, everything is whatever. So if you believe that there are things that are not valid, then that implies that there are things that are valid, that are true, right? So
yeah.
If you are opposed to that, you believe in orthodoxy. You believe in orthopraxy. Because if there is a wrong, then there is a right. So we need to stop being allergic to these kinds of words, because these words mean that our tradition has authority. It means that it has life, right? We need to stop being allergic to these kinds of things because yeah. We need to get into a period where our faith not just lives, but thrives and strives for victory. I see a world where the gods are once again put upon the thrones that they deserve as cultural standards, as the kings of our folk, as the sires of our folk. That's who they are. And we turned against them we turn our backs on them for centuries. And you know what? They've been speaking to us this whole time. We just forgot how to listen. It's time for us to come home. It's time for them to lift them back up. It's time for us to not just do our little thing and have our little bloats and kind of exist as a subset of this niche of society. It's time for us to strike out and conquer and become what we are. And that is the heathen nation, the nation of the children of the gods. That's who we've always been. And that's where we need to go. And that's just the way that I see it. And I think that it's going that way. We're starting to evolve. We're starting to mature. And we've got a lot of work to do, and we got a lot of children to have, and all this kind of stuff. But we are on our way to victory. We just have to be more victory minded. So outside of that, thank you everybody for tuning in. I'm Big Dave. You can check out my previous shows on the blog over on my YouTube channel, which is just called Dave Martell. If you're in the mood for some weird fiction, let me tell you, we just dropped Bizarchives 3. So many great authors in there. Robert C. Booth comes back. We got some really based Englishmen in there. Robert C. Booth, A. Cuthbertson, M.S. Jones, so many great guys in there. Cypress Walter, I'm in there. So many great guys from UK, from America, from all over the world. All of our guys in there. Great stories. If you want to check out some other stuff, go to thebizarchives.com. We've got The Willows from Algernon Blackwood, a supernatural horror classic, an iconic tale of the old modern world. H.P. Lovecraft said it was the greatest supernatural tale in English literature, The Willows by Algernon Blackwood. We've got M.S. Jones' debut, Sacred Times Part 1, an epic fantasy series. We got so much great stuff over there. Go to thebizarchives.com and go pick up some books. Everything is like around 10 bucks. You can't beat the price. You can't beat the stories. Support the project. Check out our Substack at theobelisk.substack.com. Follow us on Twitter and Telegram at thebizarchives. And that's all I got for today. Thank you, Dan. Hails and blessings to everybody.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. As you can hear, Dave is a doer. He has his fingers in many pies, and he's a really industrious guy. I need to pick up some of the Bizarchive stuff myself. I've got a reading pile as tall as myself at the moment, and I'm kind of reluctant to add to it. But I definitely want to get some of that stuff because we need to make room for fiction in there as well. And I think this is something that Dave would promote pretty strongly as well. You know, it's all well and good reading a lot of the non-fiction stuff that we have and reading our source material, but we need to make time for just the pure enjoyment that comes with reading some Lovecraft or some Conan stories, or some kind of more obscure pulp fiction like the stuff that the Bizarchives are publishing. So I would definitely encourage anyone to check out that website, and yeah, follow Dave on Telegram, Dave Martell, and the blog on YouTube, and check out the Culture Dads podcast as well. And Dave will definitely be returning to the Fergan podcast sometime in the near future. So great to speak to you as always, Dave, and thank you so much for making time to come and speak to me.
My pleasure.
And to finish the show off, as always, we have the answer to the riddle from last week, where I read riddle number 13 from the Exeter riddle book. The answer to that one was chickens, 10 chickens. Apparently, this is widely but not universally accepted. So if I read from the commentary in my book, Mrs. van Eerhart Siebold explains the six brothers and their sisters by pointing out that in Old English, 10 chickens, 10 chichinu or chikinu, I don't know how to pronounce that properly, has 6 consonants and 4 vowels. When it is hatched, a chicken leaves its membrane clinging to the inside of the shell. So that's quite an interesting one, really, because it seems that aspects of the riddle itself point to kind of numerical values of the answer. So that one's pretty clever. And I think what I'm going to do from now on with this section, because I know that some of you really enjoy it, I think I'm going to read out the riddle and then give a little bit of my own commentary if I have anything to say about the riddle itself. So I'll try and do that today. And so I'll read the, you know, basically try and get a bit more kind of involved myself rather than simply reading words on a paper and then giving you the answer in the following podcast. So here goes riddle number 14 for episode number 14. I was once a warrior's weapon, now a noble young retainer, dresses me in the threads of twisted gold and silver. At times men kiss me, at times I summon close friends to do battle. A horse sometimes bears me over the earth, seahorses sometimes sweep me, gleaming over the ocean. Now and then a maiden, ring-adorned, replenishes my paunch. I must lie on planks at times, plundered, hard and headless. Often, gold-garbed, I hang on the wall above drinking warriors. A splendid sight, instrument of war. Covered in riches, I draw in breath from a brave man's lungs when retainers ride towards battle. At times I tell proud warriors that wine is served. At times rally them, save booty from hostile men. Drive off the enemy. Now ask me my name. My initial hunch there with that one is that it's a horn. The only thing that throws me on that is the first line, I was once a warrior's weapon. I'm kind of struggling to see how a horn could at one time have been a weapon in the way that we know it anyway. But, you know, when we have lines like a maiden replenishes my paunch, or I draw in breath from a brave man's lungs, or at times I tell proud warriors that wine is served, or at times summon them to war. I summon close friends to do battle. A horse sometimes bears me over the earth. I think the most obvious answer that I can offer there is horn, but maybe you've got other ideas. So let me know in comments under the Odyssey video, or send me a message. Let me know what you think, or just hold on for the next episode and I shall provide the answer to that one. So I hope you all enjoyed this conversation between myself and Dave Martell. I hope you got something from it. I thought it was a pretty insightful one, if I do say so myself. And Dave's always got lots of value to offer. So, go and check out his channels and, have a look at what else he's got going on. And I shall speak to you all in the next episode of the Fergan podcast.